Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
He's turning blue, he said.
Is he talking to you right now?
No, he's just, that's all he's doing, making a noise.
All right, you just stay on the line with me, okay?
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next?
The name of the man in the ditch by the side of an Oklahoma road was Chris Lane. The strangers fighting desperately to keep him alive had no way of knowing he was a young Australian man living his dream in their normally peaceful community, or that his shooting was as random as it was devastating for his family and the families of his assailants. Chris Lane was living with his girlfriend Sarah in the small town of Duncan, Oklahoma, since winning a baseball scholarship to East Central University. Andrea Kane is one of Chris Lane's doting sisters. She joins us to talk about her family's terrible experience with what seems to be the most American of crimes, the drive-by shooting.
It never ceases to amaze me how people can tell the story again. Like often in this show, I say to people, oh, is this okay? Like, is it re-traumatising? And I guess you find a way to tell the story, do you?
Yeah, you do. And I think because of the way things happen with Chris, so many people ask.
Yeah.
And so many people that I've met afterwards, even my daughter's friends now being at school, have said, oh, he was your brother. What's your version of the story now? Because they'd read it at the time and seen it at the time.
I would feel rude asking you, I think, if our kids were friends at school. I don't think that I'd ever go, hey, you're that lady. Yeah. Like your brother won the lotto or something.
I think it's more that awkward stage, which I'm not particularly good at, is when you sort of become from acquaintances to friends.
Yes. Yeah.
More in that stage when it comes up again or something will happen that, I mean, up until now, every year there's been something, whether it's the trial, whether it's something. So every year it's sort of sparked, not necessarily by my conversation, but by something that's in the media or we have to organise. So that's where that conversation, I think they feel there's an in and then they can ask.
And certainly it was really widely covered, story, wasn't it? It was a massive news story.
It was for us.
I mean, not, you know.
It was surreal.
Yeah.
Like, there was not a news organisation, I don't think, that we didn't hear from. And that was weird in itself.
Tell us about the experience. I mean, Michelle and I have both worked in the media. We're on the other side.
Yes.
What's it like being on the side where you are being pursued essentially for a story?
In Australia, and the experience we had in regards to being pursued, it couldn't have been more respectful. The journalists that reached out, be it the Australian ones, obviously the only ones who could sort of knock on your door. We only had that happen a couple of times and they were all really good with just leaving a card and walking away. We had one group that we had come to our home after the initial press conference and they came to collect some pictures of Christopher. But other than that, they would email, Facebook message, obviously.
Yeah.
But they were okay with a no. They were okay with a not at this time. So they were really quite very respectful from what we had. But at the same time, it's very weird and you feel like you're out of your depth because you don't know what they're going to say. You don't know how they're going to take what you've said. Mm.
Well, you're not media people. We're not media people.
And you don't know how it works.
We had no concept. Yeah. Even we found it very strange. We're very lucky that one of the guys at the baseball club works as an agent manager. Mm. And he was the one that helped out initially set up the press conference because before that it was so ad hoc. We didn't tell the media. We never told anybody, I mean, other than immediate family and friends. So when it was on the radio, we were blown away.
How did people find out? How did the media find out about what happened to Chris?
To be honest, I couldn't tell you. The only connection we do know is that one of Christopher's really good friends does work at SEN at the time, and it obviously would have been high on his list. But the widespread 6 o'clock radio news, it must have been more than that as well. It was quite heavily, obviously, documented in the Duncan News, which would have happened on the Sunday.
What's the Duncan News? Is that the name of the town?
That's the name of the town. So in their newspaper in Oklahoma, there was a story, and that's actually really horrible because I linked that story and sent it to my boss and said this was my brother.
Oh,
and that's why I didn't turn up on Monday morning because I was like, where's the words? Like, how do I write that in an email? So I just sent her the link to the Duncan newspaper article.
Yeah.
And I think from there, probably it wouldn't be hard. Obviously, they scan for news every day.
Well,
and
it was
I imagine
an extraordinary
that's their job.
Story. I mean, can you take us through it? We're talking about a young Australian man who's living the dream, great at athletics, and finds himself in the States with his baseball.
Yeah.
And then he's a victim of a drive-by killing. I mean, from our perspective, it's sort of everything, all the worst things we imagine can happen in America, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
And it's something that we always say the surrealness of it and the random nature of it, I think is why we never asked why too many times.
Yeah.
Because he literally went for a run and was shot while running randomly down the street. And for us, the details came so slowly.
Mm.
So once we found out, all we found out, literally my dad, the only words my dad had was drive-by shooting. And we automatically assumed that Chris and Sarah hadn't even made it out of LA, strangely enough.
Yeah.
We just assumed, last I'd heard from Chris, he'd messaged me to say, we're laid over in LA. Don't know when we're getting our next flight. It's been delayed.
Had they been on a holiday or?
So they'd been in Australia.
Right, okay.
For Christopher had been here for about 8 weeks and Sarah had been here for about 4 or 5 of those. So we literally saw them on the Monday, Tuesday off to the airport they went. And then it was the Friday.
Wow.
So we assumed, I'd messaged him on the Wednesday. So I assumed, we all assumed, I mean, we watch enough television.
Yeah.
That when you say drive-by shooting, and we knew where Sarah lived, it's a small country town, really safe. Everybody knows their neighbours. You know, don't sort of lock your doors sort of
this
stuff.
This is the town in Oklahoma.
In Oklahoma.
Where it actually happened.
Where it happened. So we assumed LA drive-by shooting.
Yeah.
And I mean, the first thing we said was, obviously, is Sarah okay too? And then eventually we got more detail as the weekend went on. So we had 48 hours, I guess, to digest and hear bits and pieces before the media picked it up.
The first phone call that you received, was it to tell you that Chris had died?
So in our family, we're very good at black humour.
Okay.
And this is part of our story.
Yeah.
So my husband went to work that morning, as he does on a Saturday at 6 a.m. or whatever. And he rang me at 9 o'clock and he said to me, I need you to go to your mum's. And I said, okay, why? And he said, do you trust me? And I said, yep, I do. And I said, well, why? And he's like, nope, I can't tell you. You've just got to go. And so I get to my mum's house and meet my sisters there and my brother-in-law or, you know, brother-in-laws at the time. And we all joked because we thought maybe our grandfather had passed away or mum had been hurt. But mum wasn't anywhere to be found. And so we rang Nathan and said, well, what do you want us to do? And Nathan said to us, Nathan's my husband.
Your husband, okay.
And he said to me, all right, go back to our house and you all have to be there. So we joked. We won the lottery.
Yeah.
We're like, what's happened? The worst case in our mind was perhaps that our father had had a heart attack, mm-hmm. and that's why we had to tell mum. So we now assumed mum didn't know whatever this was. So sort of in a car convoy, we all get back to our house.
God, I can't imagine that
and
drive.
And we meet Nate.
And that morning.
In hindsight, it actually was not that bad because we assumed maybe dad or our grandfather, something had happened. So we all drive back, we get to our house and we can't find mum at this stage. We don't know where she is. We've all rung 1,000 times. We've all rung her friends. We can't find her. And so Nath gets there and we all sit down. And the best way I can describe it is that it's true when they say it's that wailing. So Nath basically just said to us, your dad rang me this morning and he had a phone call to say that Christopher had been shot in a drive-by. And that he didn't make it.
Mm.
And all I can remember of the moment is that absolute wailing.
Mm.
But pretty quickly we realised it was really serious and we had to find mum. And so we sort of did our find our phone app. So we found her phone located her in Fitzroy. And then once we knew she was in Fitzroy, we knew she'd been at yoga. But we didn't
know
where.
Didn't know.
So she didn't know.
Wow, okay.
So the police had told Sarah, Christopher's partner at the time,
mm-hmm.
and they'd wanted details for our family. Sarah was then taken back to her mum and her mum said to the police officer, you're not telling them.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how this works. And Cindy was actually the one that rang dad and told dad.
Sarah's mum.
So she's the one that had to make that heartbreaking phone call. Mm-hmm. And so then dad told Nathan, knowing full well that we would be all in our respective, you know, places for a Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Out and about, brunching and all of that. So we're very lucky that at least Jennifer, her partner, Erin, her partner and myself were able to be together. Then we very quickly, it wasn't about us anymore. We had to find mum.
Mm-hmm.
So once we realised she was in Fitzroy, my husband, Nathan, Erin, who is my sister, and her partner got in the car to go. Jennifer and I stayed at my house. staring at each other. To be honest, I couldn't tell you what happened in the hour when they went to get mum and returned, but we must have done something. And so they found mum in a coffee shop in Fitzroy, and mum said she just, same thing, it's that wailing that you just can't ever imagine doing.
Mm.
Like even now I still can't, I don't think I could replicate what I did in that moment.
It'd be almost primal, wouldn't it, I imagine, just from somewhere so deep inside.
Yeah, that... it's so primal. And the only thing I do remember is before we found mum, we rang dad. And even as, I couldn't tell you, I think I was 29 at the time, I rang dad and I said, you have to bring Chris home.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister said the same thing. And we said, it's so weird because you revert back to being like a five-year-old. Mm-hmm. I was like, Dad, this is your responsibility. It's not his responsibility.
Yeah, right.
But it was dad. In the time I was like, Dad, like you just have to fix this for us.
Yeah.
And I think that we all discuss in that moment, my concern was never the rest of what happened to Christopher. It was just we need him home. Mm. So Dad unfortunately couldn't get on a flight until about 6 o'clock that night. So he spent 4.5 hours in an airport just pacing up and down. Oh,
these are these flights I hear about, and I can't imagine them when people either know someone's seriously injured or has died already, and you've got to sit still on that plane for 16 hours or however long it
took. I could never think about sitting on a plane. No. I mean, Dad was lucky he was only in Adelaide, but even if Chris had been hurt and we'd had to fly, I just could not imagine going crazy in that small space either.
So your dad was only coming back home to Melbourne.
So he was just coming back home
to Melbourne. So he wasn't going all the way to the States to retrieve.
No.
Okay.
So we decided pretty early on that none of us would go unless it was absolutely mandatory. We're better together.
Mm-hmm.
At this stage, though, when we first arrived, it was quite inconvenient because the consulates were all closed for the weekend in the States, being 24 hours behind us.
Mm.
So we were basically radio silent.
Oh, God.
Other than what we had from the Harpers, which was they're just an amazing family, and what they were telling us from the detectives, what the detectives were ringing Dad about. But in regards to the process of what happened, we didn't hear from a consulate member. We didn't hear from people really until the Monday.
You which kind of think it'd be 24 hours when you were consulate. Well,
we did ask that question a few times. Like, we kept saying, like, isn't like there an emergency number?
Yeah,
like,
isn't someone on call?
Somebody to do this?
Yeah.
Apparently not so much. So we had to wait quite a while to even find out about repatriation, about what we had to do. But once we were together on that Saturday night, we have an amazing family. And Dad arrived at my house. I have, thank goodness, a slightly bigger house. So we all can fit quite comfortably. So Dad came, we were all together, and then about an hour or so later, the rest of Dad's brothers and sisters and my cousins and everyone came over, and that's pretty much how we stayed for a fortnight.
Wow, everyone together.
With everybody. We were very insular, which I think also made it easier for our family. There was always somebody to do something that we couldn't do, we couldn't bring ourselves to do, which made the whole process much nicer.
In those early days, are you thinking about the perpetrators, solving the case, all that stuff, or are you just locked into your grief?
For the first part, we were really locked into our grief. We were very lucky that they were captured very quickly.
Oh, okay.
I think once we found out that it was so random, like we kept saying to Sarah, like, is there anybody that would have hated Chris?
Yeah, of course.
Like,
what an
is
awful
there somebody
feeling.
Like, and then in our minds, we did that whole, was he in a fight?
Mm-hmm.
Was he out? Did somebody, and Christopher would never have fought with somebody, but he would have stood up for somebody. So, and I mean, that's what One Punch is all about. So we sort of thought, where was he? But when we found out he was running down the street, it was like so random.
It was early in the morning or was it in the
evening? It was in the afternoon, about 3:30.
So he's having
School was coming out.
His jog or something. You know,
He just was going back the following week, back to school, which means he'd go back to baseball training, which means lots of running. So he went out for a run. So school was about to come out before he was shot, so that was just after 3 o'clock.
Wow. So people are driving around
so
the streets,
people are driving
shooting
around,
guns.
And it's actually the school cameras that captured Christopher running up the hill as to the black car that they used in the trial and the stickers. So that's sort of part of that process. One of the schools that he ran past had the surveillance cameras.
So, I never thought of that. Of course, in the early days, you're assuming there must be a reason.
That's honestly was our first, our first instinct was either drive by downtown LA, like completely remote,
Yeah.
or was there an altercation? Was there something? And then once we found out that they had been caught, that's when more of the detail came through as to what Christopher was exactly doing, where they were, what they were doing. And we were very lucky because being so random, honestly, our first thought was these people could disappear and we would never know.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I wouldn't even know where to start.
No.
You know? So basically once they'd said that they caught them, that's when we really sort of asked those questions like why, what was happening?
Why? Why did they shoot our brother?
Why, like what had happened?
And what was
Through all those processes of like we've never seen them, Sarah's never seen them, all those sorts of things.
What was the explanation that you were given in the end? What the
They
hell?
Don't really have one. I think the real defence that was in the trial was that they were out to do no good but not to kill. But some of the evidence would disagree with that.
Who are these people?
And this is, to be honest, I don't care enough about them to remember all of them.
Don't
but Chancy Luna is the one who shot Christopher, who was in the back seat.
Okay. What's his story? How old is he?
I think he was 15. He was 15 or 16 at the time.
Wow.
Comes from a broken home. Look, your general standard kid that has lived a really hard, tough life, but also has been in a lot of trouble previously. So well known to police already by that age.
And old enough to know better.
Yeah, but know, also, like, I mean, he's 15 years old and has a gun.
Yes. Yeah. I believe it's his uncle is the one who disposed of it. So within his family, they've all come and gone from prison for various things. So doesn't really know any other way of life. And then the two others, one, Michael was the guy driving the car, and then there was another kid in the car as well.
They were all teenagers,
so all teenagers, 15, 16. I think one of them might have been 17 at the time. He was slightly older than the others. But in standard, they were actually driving one of them to an appearance at court. So that's where they were off to.
Okay.
They were off to – that's where there's footage of them being pulling – that's where they go. After they kill Chris, they go to the courthouse as one of them has an appearance for something else that he was charged with.
So have they ever offered a version of events in terms of, you know, what was going on in the car? Was he playing around with the gun?
Well, look, I think the kid in the car says that he wasn't driving and didn't kill Christopher. He says nothing was ever said. He's doing what he has to do to get himself out as early as he can.
Okay.
So he said, I didn't know anything about it. There was no conversation in the car about that intent. However, Michael, the driver, I didn't find this out till we went to the trial, till we actually got to meet the investigators, is that they swerved towards Chris. So the driver swerved the car at the same time that the gun was fired. So when a conversation was had or how or what their intent was, I do believe that they meant to hurt somebody. Mm.
The prosecutor claims that Michael Jones and James Edwards Jr. decided to kill someone for the fun of it.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, I know that, like, murder doesn't make sense most of the time, but again, it's a really odd chain of events, isn't it, to be driving to a court case and think, let's shoot someone on the way.
And I can't ever imagine thinking that way. No. So I just
but
think.
But you're right, we're not them.
I think it's the way they're grown up. They're, you know, all part of it. I mean, allegedly they were out shooting animals the day before and the week before. I do think that potentially it was a build-up.
Mm.
And whether or not they intend to kill him or to hurt him, either way, I think the intent to do something malice to somebody else was there.
It's that ingrained dysfunction, isn't it, in people's lives where it's just a mess and it's only going to end up in such a horrible act.
And I think whether it had been Chris, I no doubt believe there would have been somebody else or some other event that would have transpired down the road for them.
I can't help thinking about the difference in the two guys and their backgrounds and being Chris and Chancy Luna.
Yeah.
They're murdered polar opposites.
It's like, incredible, isn't it? Hearing you talk about your family and then hearing about Chancy Luna's family and his life. I didn't even know the word to use to describe how different these two young men's lives were and how weird it is that they collided.
And I think that in Australia we're very lucky. It's not – a lot of people think America is very similar to Australia and they think, well, there are poorer areas in Melbourne, there are badder areas where drugs and other things are really prevalent. But in the States, there are whole towns without work.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And I think that people forget that that's a generational thing.
Yes.
So there are third and fourth – I mean, he's clearly a third, maybe fourth generation with no work, no prospects – very little education, no good role models, and it's the whole community. It's not just a small suburb, it's a whole town.
Yeah. And there's towns that are completely blighted by drug addiction. I was listening to something about the opioid crisis.
Absolutely.
They're saying it's just decimating communities. And
also the African-American community has been decimated by
forever.
One blight after another.
Absolutely.
And that's, and I think that's where, when we've been over and had a look, it really is as you see on television. There are entire towns with houses falling down, no work available anywhere. Whereas here it might be one suburb surrounded by others. There it's multiple suburbs and you drive through the whole thing. From my point of view, I can really see how their lives were so different.
So was Duncan the town? Is it a town or a city?
Yeah, so Duncan's
so
a town.
A town. So was it that situation where there were areas that were very deprived and other areas that were not? Or what?
Duncan itself is actually, as a whole suburb, is picturesque. They know all their neighbours. Everybody knows everybody. The kids still walk around the street. They drive around in golf carts to visit each other. But the suburbs outside of Duncan are where a lot of these boys came from.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the areas where there is no work. The schools are being shut down. And unfortunately, there's very little hope for prosperity.
Generational poverty.
Generational within those areas.
Jail time.
So those boys didn't come from, I mean, one of them I think was sleeping on a couch of someone in Duncan, but most of them grew up outside of the actual area.
And I guess when I said before these boys were old enough to know better, actually I'll change that, because I guess there was probably never any prospect for them that their lives would improve, or they knew no better. So,
it's so hard.
Yeah, I think I think it's very much reflective of their community and society, not necessarily them. They don't know any different. They don't.
Did any of the boys or their families ever reach out to you guys?
Michael, the driver, his parents did very early on. Wow. And I know later they were in the documentary. They were publicly the first ones, I mean, they never did to us, but reach out through the media. So they were probably the first ones to say, "We're really sorry. You know, if we could trade places with Chris, we would. And we're very sorry." The other two, I mean, Chansey Luna's mum is very different. I think she suffers from some mental health issues potentially. They were very vocal. His families, I know, were ejected from the court quite often in the initial days. They weren't permitted in there because they would carry on and yell and scream. And we never heard from them otherwise. But I think Michael Jones's family, I think unfortunately they were probably a standard family whose kid got mixed up in drugs. Happens to the best of families. And I think they were probably more like us in that we would be apologizing for what our son had done, but still supporting their son the best way they know how. So the boys, one of them apologized, Michael did, on the documentary, but I've never sort of wanted anything from them. I don't hold enough anger or anything inside me that would make a difference.
Really?
Because for me, I miss my brother. I don't, whether it was those three kids or another three kids or somebody else, for me, I just think, you know, what's done is done.
Gosh, yeah. I think so many people would just allow the anger at the senselessness of it to eat them alive.
I think it's a senselessness, isn't
it? It's the senselessness.
It's so frustrating. Yes. It's
you still have your angry moments. Like, I remember one day really early on, I was so angry. And my poor girlfriend, she was at the end of it. But I think because of the randomness and then the senselessness of it, it's allowed us, and we have a very good family unit. So if one of us has a bad day, it's not all of us having a bad day. So we all get to work through our own stuff together. But I have kids. So for me, my biggest thing at the time was, and I still say to my sisters, I don't know how they got out of bed. Because I'm not sure if I didn't have my girls, how I would have.
And you were pregnant at the time.
And I was pregnant at the time. I was 13 weeks pregnant.
Oh, wow.
So for me, I couldn't think about me all the time. I had a 2-year-old who needed to be fed and nappy changed. And I actually get really sick when I'm pregnant, hugely, all day, every day until I deliver.
Wow.
And so I had no choice but to do the right thing. Because I was looking after, you know, a little one, and I really wanted to keep this baby. I kept thinking, initially I was worried that I would have lost it just through the trauma. I remember ringing my OB on the Monday morning, and I must have been crazy. And I mean that, like, literally you go a bit crazy. Because I rang him and said, I want another scan. And he said to me, what are you talking about, Andrea? You had one done like a week ago. And I was like, no, I need another scan. I just need to know this baby, like, has a heartbeat. And he was like, you'll be fine. And he hung up and then he rang my husband and he said, I've just had this like erratic phone call from your wife. What's going on? And he was absolutely amazing because he said to my husband, she can live on soft drink for as long as she needs to. As long as she's drinking a bit of lemonade,
yeah,
she's going to be okay. And I think that was really reassuring for all of us that I didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
That I knew that just by being that I would be okay and that I wouldn't lose this baby and have to worry about, you know, a whole new set of problems.
My husband broke his ankle when I was pregnant. I wanted extra scans because of the stress of that. So I really understand that feeling of...
So that was that.
Yeah.
It's hard enough just normally without that extra. And to have the... did you have the morning sickness like Princess Kate has?
Yeah, I get it all day, every day.
I can't remember the name, but no, I just say what Princess Kate has.
Yeah, pretty much that's... And it's just horrid. Oh. But in the same way, it's sort of... When I was still vomiting, I knew I was still enough hormones going around that I was still pregnant. So, you know, if I'd had a day of not being unwell, then I probably would have panicked, but I was all right. But my two-year-old is what made me get up every day.
Yeah.
And I think that how my sisters did it is their own way. And I always kept saying to people, if I had a six-year-old that I had to explain this to, I'd be devastated.
Did your little one pick up on that something was happening and mummy was really upset?
Amelia, even to this day now that she's five, has a particular connection with Christopher that is unbelievable considering she was two when he passed. And I think because it was on television and because we were all together all the time, even now she's very, very intuitive about things like that. So we moved recently and her first night she cried because she said, Christopher's stuff's not here, because we had like his stuff up around the house, only a few things. But she's very, I guess, as emotionally connected as I am to him, even though she was so young.
I guess she knows it's very important to you as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I think seeing us be sad has been good too, because even as a five-year-old now, she's very good at understanding other people's feelings rather than, I guess, if I was in a different spot, I may have said, you know, when a grandparent died, they went up to heaven and I may have, you know, glorified it slightly, whereas both my girls will say, like, where are the boys now who hurt Christopher? They're very... They want to know sort of why we get sad, why we have to do what we do. But the biggest thing for me was leaving them when we went to the trial.
After the break, Andrea tells us about the family's experience with the American media. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Andrea tells us about how she keeps her amazing attitude. But first, we hear about the American media and judicial system. Tell us about what it was like going to the States, because we can only imagine from seeing TV and movies and
what was it like? How long was in between to start off
with? So it was about a year and a half.
Christopher died in 2013.
13, and then 2015 was when we went to the trial.
Long
time. But really, we say, like, after Christopher passed, it was probably still 6 months of us putting our lives back together, starting to feel like a bit more of there was a routine about ourselves. So sort of once we got into that groove again, we were hit with when will the trial be, who will come, how we will go. We all worked through our own processes about going to the trial because it's so far away and we don't have the luxury of just popping in on a day if we wanted to, coming and going. And also we were never at any of the initial hearings. So the Harpers always went. So I felt like I had to go to be there for Chris. The biggest thing still in my mind is that if someone was on trial, then Chris's section is empty. Like the defendant has their section. It's almost like a wedding.
Yeah.
You know, Chris's side is empty to me still would haunt me.
Yeah.
So we sat down and had many a family meeting about who wanted to go, who could mentally go, because we knew that there would be autopsy photos. We knew that there would be details that perhaps some of us did or didn't want to hear. So in the end, we all decided who was going, and both Nathan and I wanted to go, my husband and I. My two sisters went without their partners, and my mum and dad came. The logistics of it was quite hard because they kept moving the trial date. various reasons. So the first time was there was a couple of appeals in there because the boys didn't want it heard in Duncan. They wanted it moved to the city because of the publicity of it. The publicity in the States is very different to here. There are no rules. Basically, when Sarah came over here for the funeral, her family were like smuggled out. And Qantas and the other people were amazing because people bought tickets to get on the plane with them.
Journalists
from America. Wow.
So they kept them like in first class. And we always joke that it's a horrible thing, but like we got rung to say that Sarah and her family had arrived and they got off like the celebrities do.
Yeah, right.
So they got off the plane at Qantas at the airport and my husband drove onto the tarmac to get them.
Wow.
Because our media were not as bad, but they know what was waiting them. So the American is very different. There's no rules. They camped out in the front of Sarah's house. There were police helicopters like following her family cars when they left looking for things. But there's also that backlash of it's also very different because like Sarah's family received death threats for the fact that, you know, it was Christopher was killed because that, you know, we're unchristian, we've done something.
Oh my God.
There's that sort of underlying tone. Is that from, like,
those weird churches?
There's very much a bandwagon. And stuff. Yeah. And then there was a bit of the gangs. The guy that actually testified that saw the sticker on the car that tried CPR on Christopher, he moved 4 times because he was threatened.
What was the sticker on the car?
The sticker was, to be honest, I can't actually tell you what it was.
It was an identifying
mark, and he's the one who saw that.
Oh, and he and his partner, they helped try and give Christopher CPR.
They gave Christopher CPR, and he was obviously pivotal to finding everything out, but he moved 4 times because of threats, whether it's from, who knows, different people.
That's intense. You're trying to do the right thing.
So it's very different to what we're used to here in Australia. So going to the trial was scary because we really didn't know what we were going to face. Like, we booked the hotel, for example, and then Sarah's mum rang us and said, you can't stay there because that's the only, there's 2 hotels and the media will be there. So they organised a house next to them has actually been vacant and was about to be renovated, and the whole community put furniture in the house for us and we stayed there.
Wow.
So it's all those sorts of things that in Australia we would be protected by, but in the States it's very different. The marker for privacy and respect is, I guess, a bit different.
Mm.
So because they kept moving the trial date and moving the trial date, it also was different about who was going to go and how we were going to go. But my biggest thing was I had a 14-month-old and a 3-year-old soon to be at home. And if Nathan and I were both going...
Yeah.
And my mum was going and my sisters were going. Who on earth were going to look after my kids? And both Nathan and I decided that it's actually the worst decision I've ever had to make because the funeral I could go to, I could take my kids, I could not take my kids. But we also didn't know how long. They'd originally said to us, be prepared to be here for a month. And so I said to mum, like, we all went with open-ended tickets because to mum, like, so how long could I be away from my kids?
You're leaving your kids at home and you don't know how long for.
No.
So who did they stay with?
So I rang my beautiful aunties, my 2 aunties, the only people I could think to leave my kids with for that long.
And that you trust, yeah.
And that you trust. And both of them were amazing. They said, absolutely, we'll leave work. We'll have as much time off as we need. And obviously they had to come and live in my house because you can't displace your children and not have any parents or aunties and uncles around. So they were absolutely amazing because I knew they would never tell me anything but my kids were good. Do you know what I mean? Like, I knew that they were going to tell me, regardless of whether Olivia had eaten potato chips all day and been sad and watched movies all day, they would just say to me, your kids are fine.
And that's what you need. It's so what you need. There's no point in telling you anything else.
Because I could not have faced anything else.
And you can't come home.
I couldn't have done anything else. And even if I was coming home, like we said before, it's a 24-hour plane trip home.
Yeah.
There's no point in me getting on a plane stressed to come home because my kids are... beside themselves.
That's it.
So once we made that decision, that was the worst. My mum picked me up in the morning to go to the airport with Nathan and I just left my kids and got in the plane. But to go to the trial without my girls meant that it got to be about me because for the first part, I was pregnant, I had kids, the funeral, I always had somebody else to look after, whereas the trial, apart from being really long 8-hour days, I knew then in the afternoon I could sit and digest what I'd seen, what I'd heard. I could think about Chris. I could talk to people that, you know, loved him just as much as we did, and it was sort of time for me too. So the trial was far harder than I would have imagined.
Did you... yeah, the emotions must have been very intense once you allowed them to come.
Yeah. And hearing, I guess being far away, we didn't have to drive past where he was shot all the time. Yes. We didn't have constant people coming up to us. And we did have that, you know, bit of, you know, removability that meant that we could face it when we wanted to. But this time around, unfortunately, we had to hear everything that everybody else potentially had known for ages.
Mm.
So initially we were taken into the courthouse and we were sat down and the team there were fantastic. Courtney and Jason and Amy said to us, what do you want to know? This is what we're going to present. If you want to see it, I don't necessarily want you to see it for the first time in the courtroom. So we kind of did look at some of the autopsy pictures they were going to show us and we kind of went through a few things. But I think I always say I saw the A5 photo of Christopher, the autopsy photo, but then when they show it in court, it's up on the wall in a projector.
Oh my God.
So it's still very different. You don't expect that. Just because you've seen it doesn't mean that it can't be shown in a worse way.
What's, what do you mean by what is an autopsy photo? In my mind, I know from, you know, documentaries and stuff where they'll show, like, a wound, but, like, not the rest of the body. Is that what you mean?
They sort of cut off, like, from his chin. So it's sort of like his torso, entire torso.
Wow.
And it was for the trajectory of the bullets.
Yes.
So it was sort of, like, on his side.
I see.
And they'd sort of angled the pictures the way that they needed them.
Mm.
So those we had to see, and the lady that performed the autopsy spoke, and then all the other sort of people that performed CPR heard noises, drove past the boys. So some of them, you're just holding your breath because you know what they have to do is just as hard as what you have to hear.
Yeah.
Especially just the lay people who went to help him. If I had to do that, I can't imagine being faced with what they were faced with. So them testifying, you're just so grateful that they're there and that they're doing that. But I've never cried so much in my life in the week that we were there. The jury are particularly funny in the States because they can chat, they can ask questions.
Can they?
They can talk during to the media.
Yeah,
too.
They can talk to the media. Yeah. Wow. It's very different.
So they can interrupt the testimony or whatever.
Well, there's a time for them to sort of ask, can they get clarification?
Oh.
You know, what had happened?
Mm. And they get door stopped out on the court steps after the day's finished and the journalists are all asking them. Wow. And they can just give their opinions. It's
and so
really
the minute
weird.
They've made their judgment, they're free to do whatever they want. So whereas here it's like you never talk about it again, you never move on. But they can say, when he said that, that's when I made it. They talk about whatever they want to.
Yeah, right.
We were very secluded during the trial. We didn't read any media during the time, but I remember my auntie ringing me one day and she said, here it seems so bad, Andrea. She said, like, what we're seeing in the news nightly, we don't know, like, how you're doing it.
There are Australian journos over there.
So the Australian journalists came over and they sat sort of behind and to the right of us. But we were, because when we opened the court doors, there was a string of cameras and media are waiting every morning and evening. We had, like, security, so they would bring us up into the courtroom in the morning and sit us down. And then during lunch, we had to go back downstairs with them, and we called it the breakfast club room because they basically locked us in this room. They fed us all the time. There was stuff there if we needed it, but we could just chat. We could be angry, sad, whatever we had to be, and then go back up again. And we weren't allowed to, because the boys' families were in attendance, we weren't allowed to use the public toilets in case they were in there.
I was going to ask that. Did you have that situation in the toilets where you met up or something?
And that was because they'd been not very happy about, you know, obviously the boys and what was transpiring. They didn't want us confronted with that. While we were there. So we were very, like, security. We went out the back door. We came in the back door. So for us, I couldn't say I lived a true, you know, experience because we were very much looked after. But it was definitely a situation of sitting there and seeing what I've seen on television is people talk about things they don't really want to talk about. You have to just sit there and do the best that you can not to say anything or do anything. And for me, my breaking point during the whole trial was when their defense lawyer in his opening statement said that he did it. So in his opening statement, he came out and said, we're not disputing that he shot him. Wow. We're disputing that that there was no intent behind it. And for me, it's the angriest I've ever been because I felt like saying, you've made me leave my kids for this. Like, if you're saying you did it, you did it.
Mm.
At least the other guys all took plea deals and admitted what they'd done.
Right.
I was like, if I'm sitting here and you're happy to say that you did it, like, why are we here? Mm. You could have just taken whatever term it was and moved on.
Did
you know?
He testify, Chancey Lerner?
So he never took the stand. So, never took the stand.
But he's in the room.
He's in the room
did
the whole time.
Did you ever make eye contact with him? Did he make eye contact with you guys?
I'd look at him like as he came in, but he was just, I don't know how he did it. He was just a ball of nothing. Like he didn't smile, but he wasn't angry. There was just a lot of nothing.
Like desensitized or something maybe.
Yeah, I don't know because I'm not the one sitting there facing. Yeah. And we didn't realise. I didn't realise life in prison over there is life.
Yeah.
So, and we laughed because we're just that family. We sat there when they came out and I honestly thought it's 50-50. Like when I went in after the jury, everyone around us said, we've got it, we're done. We think we've done enough. I sat there and thought, no, it's still 50-50. And then when we all sat down, a lot of their police officers or sheriffs, whatever you call them, came into the room. And I honestly thought, and so did my sister, they were there in case we got upset. And I thought, it's not going to come back in our favour. And then later, I was speaking to one of the guys and he said, no, Andrew, it's because their side, they kick off.
Yeah,
they're the ones.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that makes sense. Yes. Yeah. But in my mind, it all sort of attributed to where I was thinking, no, he's not going to get life. And it wasn't until they announced it and we had done our victim impact statements that I spoke to Justin, the lead prosecutor, and he said, no, Andrew, life's life.
So tell us about that moment. We have the sort of the trial and then the sentencing. Did they do it all in one day?
So normally they do it all in, they do it like we do separately.
Right.
So normally you would have the trial and then you would come back for victim impact statements and then for sentencing.
Yeah.
But we made it very clear that we were not coming back for that.
Yeah.
So the judge allowed us our victim impact statements. And so he made sort of like a precursory statement as well to sort of guide us, to let us know what would happen.
Mm-hmm. So, but you come back on this day when the judge is going to announce whether he finds this boy guilty of murder or of manslaughter, I guess, having not intended to kill Chris. Were they the options?
Yeah. Over there, it's a little bit different because over here, which we really struggled with, we thought, and so did the Australian media, they kept saying to us, how come Jason's like the lead prosecutor? How come he's wrapped it up? Like he hasn't really given intent. So over here in Australia, you have to prove intent, which is generally a text message, a conversation, or for example, someone's been stalking somebody and then they kill them.
Okay.
There's an intent there that's really clear. Actually, when you raise your arm up and point it towards somebody in the States, that's intent.
Wow.
So you actually don't need to prove that there was a conversation had in the car, which is what we sort of kept saying.
Yeah, right.
Oh, are they saying there was no conversation because that means no intent? But in the States, obviously they have different laws to we do anyway about firearms, is that the minute you've raised it and aimed it towards something, that's considered the intent.
Well, I should think so.
Yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense. You know,
it makes sense. And that absolutely makes sense. Yeah. But we didn't know this during the whole trial and I didn't quite know where we were sitting. It's so different to what we're used to.
It's like nothing you would really ever hope or expect to experience in your life ever.
No.
So no wonder you didn't know what was awaiting.
And I guess in some ways I always say, you know, sometimes it's that obliviousness that keeps you safe.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you ask too many questions, you're wondering too much about what's happening.
So what happened in that moment when the judge made the announcement that...
When he said he was guilty, I was honestly so relieved because I hadn't given much thought to him. But once we found out they'd swerved to hit Christopher, they hid the gun, they had been practicing with target shooting days before, I honestly genuinely believe he was guilty. I don't think, you know, even as a 15-year-old, a lot of people, there's debate about them being young. I don't in my mind think, oh, but... I really honestly believe he was guilty of what he did.
Oh, absolutely. And when I try and think compassionately about this guy, I feel sorry that he was in a place where he deliberately wanted to kill someone. Yeah. I don't feel sorry that he was caught or,
I don't genuinely believe, knowing now where he's come from, what he's done, if he gets out, the chance of rehabilitation is so slim.
Oh, that's so sad.
You know, because of the way that they live in, he's only going to go back to people that are doing the same sort of thing. He doesn't know anything else. So for me, when they said he was guilty and we knew that it would be 44 years or life. So at that point, and this sounds really horrible, and I know I really do love Australia and I love what we do, but you know, there are families out there who have suffered a loss and their daughters have been killed and they get 4 years.
Yeah.
Definitely. For us, I feel like in some ways I was privileged because I haven't had to put Chris's life into a box. I haven't had to say Chris's life was worth 4 years.
Yep.
Or life, which is actually 22 years old.
Or 22 years. Like, I haven't ever, I feel privileged, unlike, you know, the Morecambes and the other families, that they have had to put it into a year or 2 years. And I think for me, I'm very lucky that, you know, had he not been there, he probably wouldn't have been shot. But to work through their legal system, at least at the end of the day, you know, even 44 years, if this is overturned, is still a huge amount of time.
It certainly feels like this boy is paying with his life for taking Chris's life.
That's destroyed his life.
So,
well, as Chris,
he absolutely.
He doesn't get to go on and get married and have kids and have a life.
No. And when he gets out, he's really old.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever he can make of his life, then he could make. But yeah, I feel privileged in that sense, because I think in Australia, I do think that I would be more resentful if someone had said to me, Chris's life was worth four. I think then I'd be angry.
Yeah. So I was reading, doing a bit of researching last night, and came across a case, and, you know, it was a shocking double murder back in the 1980s. And the person who'd cold-bloodedly murdered two people, he got released in like 2008 or something. Yeah. He'd done his, I don't know, 25 years, and then just seems, I don't know.
Yeah. And I would say that until I became, until Chris was killed, I probably was one that said, you know, I don't believe in, you know, I'm pro rehabilitation. But when I look at this case and Chris's case, I just think the solution, you know, is to lock him up until there's a better one, because he's not going to get better.
What else has changed for you, like, from that experience?
Oh, I am. The empathy I have for other people now is absolutely shocks me. Wow. I was very black and white. I was very much and I hate to say this now, I was very much I think we need to let in refugees, but I think there needs to be real circumstances around how we do it. I'm ashamed to say it now. But now my empathy for other people and finding themselves in horrible situations, like what happened to Christopher for me is horrific and it's horrible, but there are families that live this every day. And for me now, I think my empathy for other people and understanding what they're going through has changed me completely as a person.
That's a really fascinating leap, and I love it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
But that is so interesting that...
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not, you're not just empathetic for victims of crime or, you know, other people who've lived very similar circumstances, but actually for anyone who's sort of living through an extraordinarily...
Yeah, anybody who's living through a hardship I just think it's, you know, that thing like you've got to walk in somebody else's shoes. Mm. I think that this has really given me that empathy that I needed to feel for other people, what I probably would have been a bit dismissive of, to be honest.
But terrible things can happen to good families and good people. Yeah.
And I think that it could happen to anybody.
Yeah.
And genuinely, it happens every day. So I find now like I can't watch the news as much as I probably used to, and things like that, because I could take on every cause, you know, like I really feel like people need an advocate, and without one, you can't get other people to see your side.
It's like things like, you know, in the news at the moment with old Barney Banana,
I call him.
You know, in the news, I just think, oh, you listen to your story and then you're talking about the compassion you've got for people in refugee situations. That's more important than what we're being fed every day.
Yeah.
And that's what I think. I think it's even when people talk about America or they talk about different countries, like as much as I have compassion, there are countries, you know, where people don't eat every day and they are terrorized by their neighbors every day. That's far worse than, you know, having an extramarital affair and spending time discussing all these things.
We're so lucky, aren't we?
So I think we are very lucky, but in being lucky, we need to remember that there are people out there every day doing something that they don't want to be doing or that they're trying to better themselves.
Do you think Australians, has it changed your mind about we as a country, what we consider important in our, do you think we're an empathetic country, a compassionate country?
I would have said yes before, but now I think we're not so much. I think we're almost at that stage where I'll call us like the lucky country, that we've got a really good middle class group who are happy, but they're not willing to give up enough to help somebody else. Mm. So I still think we're at that more stage rather than I've got enough, what could I do to help somebody else? And I think
all
that's
the victims of crime and victims' families we've met, I've never known anyone to be affected in this way.
It's really,
that's amazing.
Yeah,
is everyone shocked when you tell them this?
can I, it's probably the one thing that's said to our family the most, which is how can you be like that?
Yeah.
And I genuinely think it's because we had the biggest outpouring of people helping us. So the baseball club, Christopher's like, even the prime, we had people when we went to the baseball club day, you know, from primary school come out of the woodwork. And it's easy to say, oh, look at all these people. Like, they've come out of the woodwork just to have a look at what's happened to us. But they genuinely were there, not because they wanted to do anything or talk to us. They just wanted us to see that they were there.
Yeah.
And for me, I think even like the people in Duncan who housed us and they fed us, they had a roster going as to who was going to feed us each night of the trial. And for me, I think we've all walked away with, it's that community sense that we couldn't have done it without our community, but it's not just our community. You need to look at other people's communities and what they've got because they can't help themselves if they're all in the same situation.
And people want to help people. I think, you know, that's the whole thing with community. It's, you feel good when you're helping other people, when you're getting out of yourself and not being so self-centered. And I think that's often that insular thinking is really toxic and not helpful. But how do you, where do you now pour your newfound, you know, empathy? Like, what, have you got causes you're really strong on? Or?
I think for the moment it was more about changing like my mindset. So now I guess it's that judgment that I don't have of people. So I formed new friendships and relationships with people that I wouldn't have before, but they've all got fascinating stories to tell. And I definitely, I've always worked for the YMCA, which is not for profit, and I definitely wouldn't work for anybody else again.
Yeah, wonderful.
I would only ever work now in something that I believe has purpose.
Yep.
So doing my Bachelor of Education, but whether or not I teach or go back to not-for-profit, yeah, I generally, I always worked for the Y, so I was not-for-profit based, but now I genuinely have a drive in me that I would never have had. And I will make sure that my girls, like I keep saying, I want to take my girls overseas. I don't want to take them on a holiday. I want to take them on an experience. So we'll go and see some families and see how other people are living around the world, not just what, you know, the glitz and glamour of a holiday is.
Yeah. Get some perspective. Someone I read once not long ago said, you know, if aliens came down to Earth and wanted to see how humans live, we're not it.
Yeah.
We're such a small percentage. The way we live is not normal compared to most human beings.
Absolutely. You know? And that's what I think. I haven't joined a cause only because we still find ourselves very pigeonholed.
Yeah.
So people still say, like, will you be an advocate for gun control, or will you be an advocate for, you know, youth, this and that? But I'm sure that at some point, I listened to the podcast the other day about like driving kids in to see their parents who have been incarcerated, things like that. I think there is something down the road.
Also, you know what? Don't overcommit yourself.
Yeah. No, you know? That's what I mean. Like,
you're a mum
now.
Of little
that's,
kids. You're busy enough.
I've got to wait till I've got teenagers.
And you're still
to
be a teacher.
But there is something that I would.
But you're right. It's just him reaching out to other people.
It's reaching out to help. And I don't necessarily, you know, I'm not going to save the world. But if I can make a difference to one or two people that are not my own family, then that would be, I would say I lived a good life.
Well, you definitely if every one of us could just do that, the world would be a very different place.
It would be.
Just help some people who aren't in my family. Where are we at with the case? Are there appeals? Are there?
Yep. So they're appealing at the moment his life sentence because of his age.
So he was 17 when he was convicted and sentenced to life.
He was sentenced to
life. Is he in an adult jail or a juvenile?
Adult jail.
He was tried as an adult.
So he was tried as an adult. And that was initially why that year and a half took so long, because they wanted to prove that he was an adult even despite his age. And they were able to do that. But after the case was heard, the Oklahoma Supreme Court passed their law to say that children under the age of 18 cannot be given life. So he's had cause for appeal. But over there, appeals are not as they are here. They're not state funded. So he's appealing, but he has to do it through like a probate system and then fund a lot of it. His family have to fund it. So that will obviously take time. We were meant to have one this year, I believe, another hearing. Unfortunately, though, it's like a whole new trial. So there'll be a whole new jury and they have to present all the information. In the first trial, we were lucky because Jason believed that he presented enough that the jury knew the facts.
He's your prosecutor.
But he had, he's the prosecutor, but he had, like originally he'd said he had 20 days worth of stuff to present if if he had to. And he said this time he's going to show the full 20.
Okay.
He's determined this time that last time he showed what he needed to, but things like the swerving action wasn't actually presented because the guy said, yes, he did it, that he had less to show. So, and then once again, we all make the decision as to who goes, who doesn't go. I mean, it's really hard because we've all got kids now. But again, Mum and I have both discussed it's that nobody's sitting there. It just haunts me more than me having to go.
Yeah.
So we'll face that again when it comes to it, I guess. But either way, life for 44 years, I don't feel like I'm in a situation I would be if I was here in our criminal system. I think he'll still walk away with 44 if that's what's found. So, I just don't want to sit through the whole thing again, ideally.
Yeah, that's 20, just what 20 I don't days want to do. Is a lot, plus everything plus else everything that we'll else. Get.
That's, and I mean, he's, and he's been, they've been locked up. They actually go to holding since the day he was charged. So since 24 hours after he killed Christopher, he's been locked up.
He's been incarcerated since he was 15. Yep.
And the day that the judgment came down to say that he was guilty, they took him to adult prison. Then they brought him back only for sentencing.
God, how terrifying.
So I mean, he's actually gone.
Just threw his whole life away that day in the car. Threw his and Chris's lives away.
They just, made a really stupid decision. Regardless of what it was that they wanted to do at the time. Yeah, we just said it's really, and it's, really life-changing for us, but also for all our extended family and friends, which is, I think, what people forget, you know. They think, oh, your mum and dad. But it's actually like, we've got aunties and uncles that couldn't go to the trial.
That's it.
You know, like, that's really
No, people hard. Talk to us a lot. Sometimes I think we should have called this podcast the ripple effect. Because so often people use that phrase, don't they? The ripple effect.
And we're really interested in that broader effect, not just the details of a crime. It's like what happens
after. After the number of people who are deeply affected, their lives changed, unable to continue on the trajectory of their lives because of this stuff.
And I listened to one of your podcasts which resonated with me when it was a gentleman talking about his mother that had been killed. Is that it's not just the first year, it's the first 10, and then you aren't no longer the person that you were. Like, nobody in my family, whether it's my immediate family or outside, are the people that they were. We always say there's before Chris and there's after Chris.
We're
different people. Before.
Jane Thurgood Dove's parents describe it like that.
There's a real before and after. You're not, and that's, you know, like, that's even my cousins, you know, that were 17 at the time, that were 16, that were 12 at the time. I mean, all of them were in our home for the 2 weeks that it took us to get Christopher back and have a funeral. So it's really, people forget, like, they say, oh, you know, oh, that was your cousin. I'm so sure they get that in the playground, like, oh, that's your cousin, with no actual understanding of what that means to that family. So, yeah, it's, the ripple effect is huge.
God, you're a great spokesperson.
Going to be a great teacher. Some days.
Yeah, you are going to be a great teacher. Oh, what a good one.
Hopefully.
What a
Do you get contacted by people who might, well, I guess it might not necessarily be in the same experience with having a loved one murdered overseas, but do you get contacted by people at all?
We did. In the initial, like, fortnight, we got letters from so many families, like the Alana and Madeline, their uncle. We got contacted from so many people, even people who'd had, you know, one punch or they had a car accident when they were 18. Families who just understood what the loss would be and what you would feel. And lots of different people at the start contacting us from all different organisations saying, you know, we can do this or you can help us, you know, advocate for this or that. But we sort of really let things settle. Every now and then we get cards from different organisations, especially a lot of the Major League Baseball clubs sort of reached out and said, what can we do? How can we help? But we, without the help of people in that initial stage, we couldn't have done what we did. Even the GoFundMe page that one of Christopher's really good friends, that GoFundMe page meant that we could bring Chris home because people don't realise how expensive repatriation can be.
I thought, does the government pay for that?
No, they don't.
Oh, really? I thought they would.
Generally, it's covered by, like, your insurance when you take out travel insurance. But there's a lot of fees. This is really morbid. Basic things like, obviously, the funeral home put Christopher in a casket, but they always break. There's, like, a general standard that they're not made, you know, for freight travel.
Wow.
And so you're buying two, you're purchasing two of those. So there's a lot of things that you don't sort of think about or even know about until it happens to you. And we had a few issues because obviously Christopher was at school, so what insurance the school had versus what insurance we'd taken out for him. And so that money that came from the GoFundMe really meant that we could just bring him home. It didn't matter what was happening, we just brought him home,
yeah,
and we could worry about it later. And then we also all got to go to the States.
Mm.
So we all in our own time in that year and a half went over and visited Sarah and her family and got to see people that had written us letters. The best thing, Christopher's friends. I don't know how we met them. Obviously, Christopher was a good guy, like, and he really was. But his teammates had like a memorial in the States for him about a week after he passed, and they all wrote us letters. So we've got letters from teachers of his, from his baseball friends, from people that met him, from parents, because they live there. So they'd gone and seen Christopher play baseball every week with the university, with the college. So we've got letters from all of those people, and they're the things that sort of get you through those really hard days. Mm. And I also used to joke with my husband is that I thought he was awesome, but it proves that he was, because they had such nice things to say about him. Whereas I'm a bit biased, you know. Yeah. I'm his older sister.
Yeah.
So those sort of letters and things continued to come in from different groups and organisations that had dealt with Christopher right up until sort of like 12 months after. So they were nice. They were really lovely.
You obviously touched lives. And I think there was probably a sense of shame in this lovely young man coming to their community and suffering this fate.
They were definitely as devastated that it had happened on their territory.
Yeah, totally.
As it was to us, like, that it had happened. Yeah. And we're really lucky when you talk about the media that the Harpers are such a lovely family.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I mean, I joke, if we'd had crazies, you know, the media could be very different. If they were out the front yelling and screaming, and carrying on.
If Chris's girlfriend's family hadn't been so dignified.
But they were so dignified. And they said to us, like, Sarah didn't do any media. Well, as she said, like, she wasn't a functioning person. And then we did our press conference and she said, I want to do one, because they keep talking. And she said, I'm going to pick an Australian. And so she went and talked. But they waited for us to do whatever we had to do first. And because they were so respectful, it made the process much easier in the long run.
I don't know. It's just something you never want to go through, but you're absolutely here explaining to us what happens. Is there have you got a way that you're keeping Christopher's memory alive in any formal way?
I still have a lot of his stuff around my house. So we've got baseballs. Sarah gave us all a baseball that she took out of his baseball bag the first day or so after he passed away. And she wrote, "We love you." And we've all got them on stands. And then I've got things like pictures of him up around the house, but we always celebrate his birthday all together. And we've got my girls both have, on our trip to the States, which we call our nightmare trip, because my husband and I took a 5-month-old and a 2-year-old all the way to the States for what is a hellish trip. And then back, we came back through Hawaii. And in Hawaii, my daughter kept saying, I just want to go home. She hated the whole experience.
Yeah.
And it was a really horrible trip, only because, like, we were sad all the time and we were meeting adults. And I mean, I had a 5-month-old. Like, we were not sleeping.
Yeah.
And in Hawaii, Amelia got to the point where she was like, I don't want to be here anymore. She's like, I just want to go home to Donna and Erin, and I just want to go. And so I rang Mum and I said, Mum, you're going to have to change my flights. Like, we're going to come home. And that day, on the gift store stand at the surf shop is a little St. Christopher Protect Us badge.
Yeah.
And it's actually got a surfer. Apparently, he protects the surfers. And so my girls now each have one that they wear, and I wear one. And I say to Mum, it's just things like that, that every now and then, I think, you know, we were hating. We're in Hawaii. People keep saying, like, you're in Hawaii. And we could not have been more of a miserable family.
If you're not in the mood, it doesn't matter where you are.
I was like, I had a 1.5-year-old who's like, just let's get me home. And so my girls all have these. But we do celebrate his birthday and obviously the anniversary. And it's getting slightly nicer now because we've all got young kids. So rather than going out for dinner and just staring at each other, which is what we used to do, now we've got kids, we try and go to the park or make it a really good day out for all of us. Because Christopher loved kids. Like, he's the type that would say, you take your kids to mass with you so you get to play. You still get to do your serious stuff, but they're there.
Yeah.
So we try and now make it sort of more about them, and they blow out the candles on the cake and all that sort of stuff. So that's nice.
Thanks so much for coming in. I don't know what I expected you to be like, but this wasn't it. No? I didn't expect laughs. I didn't expect, you know, this, like,
I thought you'd be quite open, but it's really exceeded my expectation. Oh, yeah. It's really inspiring. And
I think it's when it happens to the everyday person.
Yes.
You've got to take what you can out of it, you know. That's all you can do.
Yeah.
Because it happens every day to so many families that we're not as privileged as we were to have the support that we have.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook.